Before we go on to the social effects of the Harmon case, and again, the key role of Gustav Noske in forming the Freikorps, which paved Hitler's rise to power, his role as police commissioner of Hanover, and the police were quite apparently running Fritz Harmon, the man who killed 127 people, bears some unnerving similarities to what we've been looking at in a number of other shows for quite some time now. In a program we have on file with archives on audio called The Ultimate Evil, we looked at, among other things, connections of the Manson family with their horrible killings in Southern California and the Son of Sam killings in New York done by David Berkowitz, not only to explicit neo-Nazi organizations, but also to some satanic cults as well. And we've speculated at length about satanic cults as, at least in some cases, fronts for national security activity. Again, our tape called The Ultimate Evil, we'll talk about that. Mae Russell, whose work we rely on heavily on this program, in many ways did some pioneering research with her study of organizations like the Manson family, the Simeonese Liberation Army, what she referred to as the California violences. Many of the horrible serial killers, the brutal, seemingly senseless murders which afflicted California under the governorship of Ronald Reagan. Well, California really was not beset with these kinds of killings on a regular basis before then. There have been killers, including some serial killers, in all societies throughout time, but the sudden explosion of Manson family, zebra killer, zodiac killer type activity was particularly characteristic of the Reagan administration. We've speculated, based on May's research, that in essence the Reagan administration in California could be looked at in a manner similar to the Spanish Civil War, in which many of the tactics which were later to prove so successful in Europe were in fact tried out on a small scale during the Spanish Civil War. We've speculated, and May has speculated, has gone on for many years, about the California violences as, in essence, a form of terrorism, which later has proved very applicable to the society as a whole. Recall not only the hard links of the Manson family and to Nazism, but also the political connections. We talked about that in Radio Free America number 12, as well as The Ultimate Evil. But also, in attempting to get a grasp on this kind of information, and by the way, I think I feel safe in speaking for NIF, that we understand that new listeners to this program are going to have a real hard time with this kind of stuff. But again, we encourage people to reading. The reason I'm citing these references is not to prove how clever I am, but to enable people who want to pursue this to get the documentation, okay? But just look within yourselves and how people react to these kinds of things. It basically, it's not only scary and depressing, but it produces a basically conservative political trend in society. People just get this view that, hey, there are these nuts running around, these screwballs, you know, these angry whatevers, you know, be it, you know, hippies, blacks, or whatever, who are just ready to carve you into shish kebab. They get the feeling in particular that their children aren't safe, that something has to be done. We need law and order. We need strong police. We need a lot of jails. We need more rigorous courts. It really, even though it may not apparently have an ostensible political meaning, it is a very, very political phenomenon, and it benefits the political right. And we're looking not only at the Harmon case, but also by historical analogy, the California violences and many of the other things we've seen, these serial killings, which seem to be bedeviling the United States, I use the term advisedly, as basically analogs and as political provocations meant to foment political reaction in society.
Now to go from the macro to the micro, first still at the macro level, or at least talking about the wider picture here in the United States today, those who think these things don't have an effect might think of the various serial killings that have gotten such play in the California newspapers over the last few years, the Archie Fain, the Hillside Strangler cases, the people of this ilk.
Who was the guy who chopped off that gal's arms, and there was a huge hubbub.
I've forgotten his name, but I know exactly who you're speaking about. The one who was let out of prison and they couldn't find a place to keep him, and now his name has slipped my mind. But we might all notice, of course, what happened to the quote liberal unquote Supreme Court in the state of California, as has happened in another way with the once liberal national Supreme Court. It is no longer, in fact, a liberal Supreme Court. It is, in fact, a stacked conservative Supreme Court, both at the state and the national level. Now, back to the time that we're talking about. If we had only the evidence of the fact that this man, Fritz Harmon, was, although supposedly feeble-minded at the same time, was working for the police, running a string of informers, had a phony detective agency.
The police under Gustav Noske.
Yeah, the police under Gustav Noske, and later pulled off something in the neighborhood of 120 to 150 murders. The real skeptics out there might be able to still be skeptical.
And not just murder, but he chopped people up and sold them as meat.
Yes, an enterprising, feeble-minded guy. Now, however, when we put this into the context of the Nazis never one to miss a trick, and in a way, it's sort of ironic that the communists used the Harman case to tar the police with the epithet of homosexual in their own bid for power, because then later the communists themselves got sucked into the same trap. A man by the name of Martinus von der Lubbe supposedly burned down the Reichswehr. Martinus von der Lubbe was
Reichstag.
Thank you. Excuse me. Supposedly burned down the Reichstag. Von der Lubbe was supposed to be a communist. He was also another feeble-minded person who, it's very hard to believe that this man could have done this work, but the Nazis managed to string a large amount of their political victories onto this event, the burning of the Reichstag, by a, quote, feeble-minded communist.
Right. In fact, now, bear in mind, the Reichstag was the German parliament building. Hitler had been appointed chancellor by Hindenburg, and then he assumed office, I believe it was January 20th, 1933, and it was February 27th, 1933. Just coincidentally, the German parliament burns down. They blamed it on Martinus von der Lubbe, who was on the scene. Now, he was not only legally insane, he was also legally blind, which is interesting. Also interesting, Hermann Göring had a house immediately right beside the Reichstag, which just so happened to have a tunnel which joined it with the Reichstag building. He and the other top Nazi leadership appear on the steps of the burning Reichstag, blamed it on the communists, had a forceful march, and then used that as an excuse to suspend democratic leadership, democratic political process in Germany, declare themselves dictators to protect the republic from the communist menace. And then, interestingly enough, right at that time was when the formal crackdown on homosexuals in Germany came, along with a crackdown on everybody else.
Now, not to draw the net too wide, but I was just watching a broadcast on TV the other night called Television, which some of you may have seen, which was basically a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing. But again, we saw the rather poignant scene of one Lee Harvey Oswald being brought out of police headquarters in Dallas, and reporters saying, you know, did you shoot the president? And Lee Harvey Oswald, the supposed megalomaniac assassin, saying, I didn't shoot anybody. And a moment later being shot himself, of course, and not being around to make those kind of protestations any longer. One thinks of Martinus von der Lubbe sitting around in a Nazi court, wondering how the heck did I get here, and what the heck am I being accused of?
We're going to go back to the Pink Triangle in a second, but one point that should be made, I think, also since Nitt brought that up, is that in Weimar Germany, as we looked at in a broadcast that's also on file with archives on audio called They Thought They Were Free, there were many people who tried to warn about the Freikorps killings, tried to warn about the coming of Hitler, what his policies would mean. Most people did not buy it, and in fact, today, people who engage in the kind of work that Nip and myself and May Brussel are in are referred to either as conspiracy theorists or paranoid. And the terms in Weimar Germany, they didn't have the psychobabble hadn't reached the same state. They were called alarmists, not paranoid, and they were called conspiracy mongers, not conspiracy theorists, but yet another disgusting parallel.
All right. Now, again, so when we think about things like the Reichstag fire and other things, and we think about the rise of Gustav Noske, and then we look at the Fritz Haarmann case, and in the light of the, as we're going to see especially later on, in light of the eugenics theories of the Nazis, some of the utility of the Haarmann case to the Nazis pushing for power become apparent. We're going to read a little bit more from the Pink Triangle, and then I think we're going to take a break. Anyway, talking about right after and during the time of the Fritz Haarmann trial, the pitch of public hysteria mounted. Many mothers now panicked when their children did not return on time from school, which was all the more understandable because the police had begun arresting child murderers in other cities as well. In Berlin high schools, a grim ditty made the rounds. Wait with patience, little mouse. Fritz will soon come to your house. With his axe so sharp and neat, he'll make you into red chopped meat. Hirschfeld's appearance as an expert during the Haarmann trial seems only to have deepened the public's animosity toward his committee. It infuriated the Nazis that the main vehicles for sexual reform, the Scientific Humanitarian Committee and the Institute for Sexual Research, were founded by Magnus Hirschfeld, a social democrat, a Jew, and a homosexual, and that Kurt Hiller, his administrative successor, and many other members were Jewish and liberal, made it easy for Hitler's early followers to vilify all efforts to abolish paragraph 175. As early as 1920, Josef Goebbels' weekly Der Angriff had expressed its malevolence after Hirschfeld was beaten following a lecture in Munich. The newspaper praised the students for the, quote, sound thrashing administered to Hirschfeld. 7 years later, Wilhelm Frick, a lawyer, later famous for drafting the anti-Jewish Nuremberg laws in 1935, denounced the Social Democrats on the floor of the Reichstag. Quote, your party, at its last convention, has demanded the repeal of all laws concerning adultery and homosexuality, and you seem to believe that this will contribute to a moral regeneration of the German nation. We National Socialists are convinced, on the contrary, that men practicing unnatural lechery between men must be persecuted with utmost severity. Such vices will lead to the disintegration of the German people. When in 1929 the Social Democrats and the Communists had succeeded in getting a crucial parliamentary committee to vote in favor of bringing before the Reichstag a bill to strike down paragraph 175, Hitler's official newspaper wrote, quote, we congratulate you, Mr. Hirschfeld, on the victory in committee, but don't think that we Germans will allow these laws to stand for a single day after we have come to power. Among the many evil instincts that characterize the Jewish race, one that is especially pernicious has to do with sexual relationships. The Jews are forever trying to propagandize sexual relations between siblings, men and animals, and men and men. We National Socialists will soon unmask and condemn them by law. These efforts are nothing but vulgar, perverted crimes, and we will punish them by banishment or hanging. Well, as we all know, banishment would have been lucky compared to what was done. We're going to talk more about that in a moment. I think one other thing that should be mentioned in light of these things that we've been talking about and the effect on the body politic, sometimes in very subtle ways, of these kinds of activities. One of the big things that's gotten a lot of press lately through no small amount due to the help of the fundamentalist Christian movement is the issue of not only of child molestation but of child kidnapping in general. And I remember reading an article the other day where somebody was talking about the fact that there were figures being tossed around of 15,000, 20,000 children being kidnapped every year. These horrifying statistics. And, you know, of course, all the milk bottles and the Donahue shows and the milk carton pictures and the Donahue shows and the Oprah Winfrey shows and everybody talking about that. And it was actually an FBI agent, one of those treasures, an honest and sensible FBI agent. And he was saying, look, let's put it this way. You know, how many people do you know who've ever had a child kidnapped? He said 98% of all the child kidnappings are one parent, you know, a divorced parent snatching the kid. It goes down as a kidnapping, but everybody knows who's got the kid. You may not be able to find them immediately, but they're not molesters. They're parents. He said in reality there was something like, and I can't remember the exact figure, so I'm making it up here, but this is approximate. There was something like 25 to 75, somewhere in that number of unsolved kidnappings of children per year. Now, admittedly, no unsolved kidnapping of a child is a good thing, and many terrible things do happen to children. But when you consider that the average person in this country who doesn't bother to read the newspapers carefully hears things like 15,000, 20,000 children kidnapped, hears murder, torture, mutilation, satanic ritual stories thrown about left and right, it's no wonder that that we begin to see this kind of hysteria. And then when you link it to the AIDS hysteria, we have a genuine, frighteningly reactionary movement taking place.
Beyond that, our discussion of the Temple of Set, which may very well be an intelligence front of sorts, the fact of the matter is that they do molest children. They do kidnap children. The numbers I'm not even going to begin to dispute because I myself am not in a position to comment. But I do, one of the things that we've spoken about in connection with these satanic cults, one of the many strategic considerations is that it does, in fact, provide excellent, excellent grist for the mills of those reactionary Christians who want to exploit this sort of thing to try and drive people into their own ranks. And again, I think, in addition to the blackmail and the other considerations we've talked about, desensitization to violence, that's something to think about. But again, the thing before, because we're going to break here in a second, keep in mind the Harmon case, the extent to which it panicked people, the extent to which it tarred the gay rights movement with this horrible, bloody stigma, and the extent to which it was used by the Nazis, to stigmatize their political opponents, Magnus Hirschfeld, the commie, Jew, homosexual pervert. You know, that again, that's the central point here, and of course, with that champion of human rights, Gustav Noske, as the police commissioner, it shouldn't prove all that surprising that Hanover would be the site of this particular apparent provocation.
Of course, we are looking at the James David White or Jeff David White case in a very similar context here. And again, in our tape on the ultimate evil, we took a look at strong indications that the Process umbrella cult was in fact an intelligence front. That's a satanic and Nazi cult specifically, which among other things was involved with elements of the Manson family and the killings in L.A., the Son of Sam 44 caliber killings in New York, and other serial killings and apparent provocations. And again, it's an election year, and here we're seeing accounts of child molesting faggots from hell with AIDS, and one wonders to what extent, among the many strategic considerations, as I said on the tape segment there, the use of satanic cults to panic people and to help feed the mills of right-wing Christianity is worth thinking about here, too, and to help pump up the Falwells and the Robertsons and so forth. Again, bear in mind the Fritz Haarmann case as you listen to the following account, this coming from the San Francisco Chronicle of Saturday, April 2nd of 1988. This story is an AP story, I should say, Dateline, Macomb, Mississippi, headline, rumors that a satanic cult planned to sacrifice a virgin reached a... Let me start again here. We're having some engineering problems. Let me adjust my tape levels. There we go. I have to play engineer and editor and so forth here all at the same time. It's not always the easiest thing to do when you're trying to read. Beginning again, Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle, Saturday, April 2nd of 1988. AP story, Dateline, Macomb, Mississippi, cult sacrifice rumors stir up Mississippians. Rumors that a satanic cult planned to sacrifice a virgin reached a peak here this week, leading people to keep hundreds of children home from school and inundate police with calls. Despite the hysteria, police and school officials said extensive investigations did not produce any evidence to support the rumors. Pike County residents locked their doors and kept children home from school by the hundreds on Thursday, the day the rumors said was the intended date of the human sacrifice. We have a 30% absenteeism in the district, Macomb Assistant School Superintendent Leslie Daniels said Thursday. Some of that is due to the weather. Some of it is because it's the day before a holiday. But from the calls we've had, I believe much of it is from the rumors. There are about 3,700 students in the district. Sheriff Robert Lawson has said in the past that there are 22 members of a satanic cult in Pike County, and that the group has probably sacrificed dogs, cats, goats, and other animals in secluded areas. Officials said that the latest rumors led them to fear that the public may act irrationally if someone was identified even erroneously as one of the cult members. As paranoid as this public is, some innocent person could get hurt, said Lee Barkdell, Macomb's acting director of public safety. Since about March 24th, Barkdell's office has handled dozens of calls from residents worried by reports that a cult planned human sacrifices and that several Macomb school children were on a list of potential victims. Police believe the story spread quickly in schools, reaching a crisis level when parents got wind of it. Students at Gibson High School said teachers canceled tests on Thursday when classes began with small numbers of students. They also said rumors persisted that Satan worshippers planned a midnight march through town with a later sacrifice of a baby and a 13-year-old. Bear in mind, of course, this particular weekend was the weekend of Easter Sunday. April 1st was Good Friday. Sunday, April 3rd of this particular year, 1988, was Easter Sunday. And again, bearing in mind the Fritz Haarmann case, you know, be still and quiet, little mouse, Fritz is coming to your house, etc., etc., it's worth thinking about. Given the OTO links, and again, we're not talking necessarily about the OTO as an organization, but perhaps rogue elements of it, ex-members, or perhaps a faction of same, suggests at least the possibility here that the activities of James David or Jeff David White and perhaps the St. Joseph fellow as well may have been connected with elements of the Process Umbrella cult. One of the killings in the book The Ultimate Evil was in fact a gay killing. Some New York high rollers were, in fact, a fellow who was a diplomat associated with the United Nations, I think the son of a diplomat, was involved in one of those particular cases in The Ultimate Evil. But again, they're in speculating about satanic cults basically as fronts for mind control and espionage activity by the National Security Establishment, the use of sexual blackmail, the use of the cults as desensitization programs to train murderers, which we're going to talk about in a second, and as propaganda devices to defame individuals or to panic the public into thinking the whole society was going nuts and they needed law and order. That's something to think about here. Again, it's interesting that there's a North American Man-Boy Love Association group at West Point. That's one of the areas where there were child molestations, as there were at the Presidio. A lot of military bases have had serious, serious problems in this regard. And in The Ultimate Evil, one of the Carr brothers was murdered on Minot Air Force Base, where a branch of the Process Umbrella cult was apparently located. So again, bear in mind the Fritz Haarmann case, as we see these persisting accounts of, quote, gay child molesters from hell with AIDS, and the thought of some geek out there running around sodomizing people's little children and giving them AIDS certainly won't work against the prospects of political reaction during the coming presidential election. Well, I've been joying at you for quite some time here, live or on tape. We're going to take a musical break and then come back with the next section of tonight's archive show. Welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. Welcome to our archive show this evening. We are beginning the first of maybe a three-part series, maybe a four-part series. It's going to be Ultimate Evil 2, next week 3, maybe even 4. Now, we were looking at a couple of cases involving accounts or reports, I should say, of gay satanic cults, one involving a murder, one involving not only child molestation, but a network of child molesters, one of whom at least appears to have had AIDS and may have been infecting his victims with that disease. We looked at that against the background of the Fritz Haarmann case, an apparent provocation in Weimar Germany that was used to great effect by the Nazis in their rise to power to defame the opposition with overtones of immorality and so forth, perversion, etc., etc. We're now going to take a look at another possible use of satanic cults. One of the purposes that I personally feel these cults serve the national security establishment, and again, the point should be made that this broadcast rests directly on the foundation of our archive show, The Ultimate Evil, Part 1. That, in turn, was a compilation of several different segments of One Step Beyond shows, and again, indicating that in fashion similar to some of the cults we looked at in Radio Free America number 7, in fact, some satanic cults are, in fact, being used by the intelligence services and military as fronts for all kinds of activity, including explicit Nazi activities. We're going to get back into the Temple of Set somewhat later. We're going to look now at the St. Joseph case. That was the case of Cliff St. Joseph, a waiter who reportedly had committed a terrible murder in connection, well, he was convicted of a terrible murder in connection with, quote, a gay satanic cult. We're going to take a look at a longer account of the Cliff St. Joseph case, this coming from the L.A. Weekly of March 4th through 10th of 1988. This is a story by J. Alex Constantine, Jr., and it's called San Francisco's Satanic Slaying. On a blustery morning last August, the preliminary hearing on the murder of, quote, John Doe 60, unquote, began in a hushed San Francisco municipal courtroom. Charged with first-degree murder is Cliff St. Joseph, a tall, bulky, 45-year-old waiter who also faces charges for the kidnapping and false imprisonment of Rick Hunter, a 22-year-old street hustler. St. Joseph listened intently as forensic pathologist Dwight J. Straub, S-T-R-A-U-B, took the stand and recited the coroner's report. A 2 to 3 inch slash on the upper lip, burns and cuts to the neck, stab wounds on the chest, 6 to 9 inches long, forming a pentagram, a deep cut to the genital region, abrasions on the wrists and ankles. Judge Leonard Louis began to fidget as Straub's recitation grew more grisly. Molten wax in the right eye, an incision to the penis extending to the anal region, blood drained from the body, clusters of bruises on the back and buttocks. More gruesome revelations were yet to come in one of California's most bizarre cult-related murders when key prosecution witness Ed Spela, S-P-E-L-A, took the stand to tell a harrowing tale of his introduction to Satanism and his role in the kidnapping of Hunter. That is the false imprisonment of Rick Hunter alluded to earlier. Spela, a 26-year-old former male prostitute, had driven to San Francisco from Reno in June of 1985. In need of a temporary place to stay, he called on his old buddy St. Joseph, whom he hadn't seen for several years. St. Joseph agreed to let him stay in the apartment he shared with friend Maurice Bork, an escaped convict and another acquaintance. Soon, Spela says, Spela, by the way, is S-P-E-L-A. Soon, Spela says, St. Joseph began proselytizing his satanic beliefs. He told me he was the devil, Spela testified, and he asked me if I'd ever killed anybody just for the sheer joy of watching them die, unquote. St. John took Spela around to a back alley where he pointed out a mattress with a 3-foot bloodstain. He said that he, Bork, and another friend, unquote, had used the mattress in the sacrifice of an unknown victim, allegedly John Doe 60, 2 weeks earlier. St. Joseph explained the sacrifice process in detail. The first incision was to John Doe 60's mouth, quote, to seal it for eternity, unquote. Then a pentagram was carved on the victim's chest. The final cut was to the scrotum, said St. Joseph, who added that they drank the victim's blood from a gold chalice. He said that afterwards they dumped the body, wrapped in plastic and a blanket, and bound with guitar strings, under a truck in San Francisco's warehouse district. Another admitted accomplice, Maurice Bork, would later testify under limited immunity that these details were true, also confirming that St. Joseph and the still unidentified friend ate the victim's testicles in an age-old satanic bonding ritual. Bork added that the sacrifice was conducted by candlelight with music by Black Sabbath spewing from a multi-speaker stereo system. Initially skeptical, Spela began to suspect that St. Joseph's talk about human sacrifice was more than a joke when St. Joseph and Bork hauled out books by Aleister Crowley on satanic lore. Spela was told that he could meet their entire satanic group if he first participated in a human sacrifice and that, quote, doors, unquote, would open for him in the business world upon induction. Well, there are a couple of things to bite on in this article. It's interesting to note that he was told that if this fellow was told that if he joined the cult and participated in a sacrifice, then doors would open for him in the business world. Blackmail and the political manipulation is one of the things we've hypothesized about as being one of the national security establishment's interests in pursuing this type of activity. If you get someone compromised, whether molesting a child or participating in one of these bloody rituals, you've got that person. And if you use a carrot and stick approach, and if you threaten them with blackmail and destruction, if they go back and attempt to reveal these things, and with continued professional advancement, if they keep their mouths shut, that's a very persuasive way of bending people to your will. One of the other aspects of the satanic culture that we would like to examine as a hypothesis for what the national security establishment may be using some of them for. And again, in Ultimate Evil number one, we took a look at indications that, in fact, the national security establishment is employing some of these cults for various purposes. One of the things that I suspect they may be using them for are vehicles for training professional mind control killers, for desensitizing people to violence, and using them specifically as some of the mind control assassins that we looked at the development of in Radio Free America series 5, 6, and 7, primarily 5 and 6. After I change the cassette side here, because again we're nearing the end of a cassette side and I don't want to miss any of the tape segment that we're about to play on the master, I don't want to lose any text, we're going to go now in just a second and listen to part of Radio Free America number 5, again right after I change the tape here. Play a short section now of Radio Free America number 5. Specifically now, we're going to take a look at a program under which the military, specifically in this case the Navy, certainly has been, training assassins through using various mind control techniques or combinations of techniques to function out of U.S. embassies and at the behest of the national security establishment around the world. Now, the process that we're about to look into, and again, the section of tape that you're about to hear comes from Radio Free America number 5, Operation Mind Control, Part 1, takes a look at the desensitization process whereby normal citizens are systematically acclimated to increasing degrees of horror and bloodshed, this then making them cold and efficient assassins when they go out to do their work. And a process of acclimating them to bloodshed and murder, or bloodshed and violence, is very deliberate, very scientific, and uses the exposure to scenes of violence to desensitize the victims in an altogether scientific manner. And again, the use of mind control to train assassins is unfortunately a much ignored but prevalent aspect of the U.S. intelligence system and military. It's been going on for more than a quarter of a century. Unfortunately, most people don't acknowledge that. However, again, reflect, this much of this show is, of course, of a hypothetical nature, but reflect on satanic cults and on the kinds of activities that we looked at here in connection with St. Joseph against the background of Radio Free America number 5. It's interesting, too, that these particular killers used some of the works by Aleister Crowley as well. Again, the OTO grew out of Aleister Crowley's work. Again, raises the question here of just where Crowley fits into the whole picture, where the OTO elements thereof, splinter elements thereof, sections thereof may fit into this entire process. As I say, I do think there are OTO-connected elements within the process umbrella cult that we're talking about. Again, that does not necessarily impugn the whole organization for reasons explained exhaustively above, and I'm not going to go into it again beyond what I've said. But reflect on radio against, reflect on these satanic cults and on the sorts of blood drinking that we talked about here, the carving of pentagrams in the chest. Reflect on this kind of activity against the background of desensitization to violence. And bear in mind that as we look at in the first part of The Ultimate Evil, many of the people who head up these cults do not, in fact, believe in the devil. In fact, the poor slobs who were used at the operational level are being manipulated for their own purposes. And one wonders here if perhaps some of these satanic rituals serve the purpose specifically of training people and acclimating them to violence so that they can be used for later purposes. Again, we're going to go into now a short section of Radio Free America number 5. Here we go.
All right, continuing from Bord's book on a new chapter and on a rather interesting series of revelations of fairly recent vintage. This is just starting at the beginning of Bord's book, chapter 11, A School for Assassins. The author writes as follows. The cryptocracy, and by the cryptocracy, Bord is referring to the people at the top of various intelligence groups interested in this sort of secretive behavior in terms of experimental mind control. So he's using it as a generic term. It doesn't have any specific significance to any specific people. The cryptocracy recruited their assassins from among people who had already demonstrated a violent nature, people who had few reservations about taking human life. No homicidal maniacs were recruited because they could not be controlled. The cryptocracy needed killers who would not murder on impulse, but only upon command. Once selected, the assassin candidates were turned over to the military, where, under the guise of, quote, combat readiness training, they underwent a complete program of conditioning. Graduates of the program would forever after act with ruthless efficiency. They would eliminate local political leaders in a foreign country, or undertake search and destroy missions in violation of national and international laws. They would be given the cover that would allow them to enter the foreign service, or they would pose as embassy marine guards. In July 1975, the Sunday Times in London quoted a U.S. Navy psychologist who admitted that U.S. naval intelligence, and I just interrupting for a moment, you'll remember that U.S. naval intelligence was one of the groups earlier that was funding Delgado's research, as well as other mind control research. The U.S. Navy psychologist who admitted that U.S. naval intelligence had taken convicted murderers from military prisons, conditioned them as political assassins, and then placed them in American embassies around the world. This admission came shortly after the Senate Intelligence Committee had scolded the CIA for plotting a number of political assassinations around the world. From the congressional reports, however, one got the feeling that the cryptocracy was being chastised not for the assassinations it had successfully accomplished, but for those which it had attempted but failed. The attempts on the life of Fidel Castro drew the greatest notice from the congressional committees and the press. According to the Sunday Times story, naval psychologist Lieutenant Commander Thomas Narutt, N-A-R-U-T, was assigned to the U.S. Regional Medical Center at Naples, Italy. When he first made public the Navy's part in programming assassins, he was attending a NATO conference in Oslo on dimensions of stress and anxiety. In attendance at that conference were 120 psychologists of all descriptions and from many countries. Many of them were involved in research on how to improve man's ability to cope with stress, but none of them felt compelled, as Narutt did, to discuss their work so fully or so frankly. The stated objective of the conference was to exchange information on how soldiers and people in difficult jobs could cope with stress. Dr. Narrett's talk was on, quote, the use of a symbolic model and verbal intervention in inducing and reducing stress. His speech began with a plug for the Navy. He knew, he said, that many of the scientists present had often encountered problems in their purely scientific research because of the military's inclination to research that would yield quick and useful results. He sympathized with those who had trouble getting subjects, funds, or both out of the military for their purely scientific research. But things were different in the Navy, he said. In the Navy, Narrett bragged, there were plenty of captive personnel who could be used as guinea pigs. In the Navy, there was a computerized record of each man's background and psychological profile, so that a quick selection of men with suitable psychological inclinations for experiments could be made. Navy psychologists not only had access to computerized records, but also to psychological tests and background data on a large number of people. In the Navy, Narrett said, funds were plentiful and there were no problems with transporting subjects for study to nearly any place in the world. Narrett stated proudly that the U.S. Navy provided scientists with the most advanced research facilities in the world. A Canadian psychologist at the conference later remarked, Narrett's message was loud and clear, join the Navy and study the world. In his brief discourse, Dr. Narrett did no more than hint at the work he had been doing in teaching, quote, combat readiness units to cope with the stress of killing. Later, however, during private questioning with a small group of listeners, reporter Peter Watson of the Sunday Times, a former psychologist among them, Narrett in full unfolded the amazing story of the Navy's programming of assassins on an assembly line basis. In his mid-30s, Dr. Narrett had just completed his doctoral dissertation on the question of whether certain films provoke anxiety, and whether forcing a man to do irrelevant tasks while watching violent films would help him cope with the anxiety they produced. When pressed by Watson to explain the details of this kind of conditioning, Narrett said that he had worked with, quote, combat readiness units, which included men being programmed for commando-type operations and for undercover placement at U.S. embassies. These, Narrett said, were, quote, hitmen and assassins, Narrett's own words, made ready to kill in selected countries should the need arise. Dr. Alfred Zitani, an American delegate to the conference, was very surprised by Narrett's disclosure. Quote, do you think Dr. Narrett realizes what he has just said? Zitani asked. That kind of information must be classified.
The conditioning of Narrett's assassins was accomplished by audio-visual desensitization, a standard behavior modification process. These men were desensitized, unquote, to mayhem by being shown films of people being killed or injured in a number of different ways. At first, the films would show only mild forms of bloodshed. As the men became acclimated to the scenes of carnage, they would see progressively more violent scenes. The assassin candidates, Narrett explained, would eventually be able to dissociate any feelings they might have from even the goriest scenes they viewed. Narrett said that, of course, U.S. naval psychologists would have first selected the candidates for training by their psychological makeup. Those selected for assassination assignments were often from submarine crews and paratroops. Others were convicted murderers from military prisons who had already shown a proclivity for violence. Still others were men who had been given awards for valor. World War II Medal of Honor winner Audie Murphy was a subject of extensive research. The best killers, according to Narrett, were men whom psychologists would classify as passive-aggressive, unquote, personalities. These were people with strong drives that were usually kept under tight control. Such types were usually calm, but from time to time would exhibit outbursts of temper during which they could literally kill without remorse. Narrett said that through psychological testing, he and his colleagues were looking for more such men for further conditioning.
Among the tests used by the Navy to determine violent natures was the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, which is used widely by educators and businessmen to determine psychological qualities of students and employees. The tests consist of hundreds of questions designed to measure such personality traits as hostility, depression, and psychopathy. According to Narut, the men selected by the tests or by evidence of past violence were taken for programming to the Navy's Neuropsychiatric Laboratory in San Diego, California, or to the Naples Medical Center, which employed Dr. Narut. Audiovisual desensitization was the major technique used in programming the assassins. Psychological indoctrination completed the programming by instilling the desired prejudicial attitudes. The audiovisual desensitization began with the subject strapped into a chair with his head clamped so that he could not look away from the screen. A special mechanism prevented the subject's eyelids from closing. The candidate was then shown a film of an African youth being crudely circumcised by fellow members of his tribe. The youth was circumcised with a blunt knife, painfully, and without anesthetic. This well-known film is used widely in psychological experiments to create stress. Afterwards, the candidate was asked about details of what he had seen. He was asked, for example, to describe the color of the belt on the doctor's trousers or the motif on the handle of the knife that cut off the foreskin. The next film showed a man in a sawmill where planks were sliced from huge logs. In the operation of the saw, the man slipped and cut off his fingers. As the films progressed in gruesomeness, the reactions of the candidate were measured by sensing devices. Heartbeat, breathing rate, and brain waves were recorded, very much as on a polygraph. That, of course, is a lie detector interrupting here. If the physiological responses, which might have been great in the beginning, slowed down and resumed normal patterns as the more bloodthirsty scenes were viewed, the candidates were judged to have completed this stage of conditioning.
Continuing on with Boer's Operation Mind Control, the last phase of conditioning, Narut said, was to indoctrinate the candidates to think of their potential enemies as inferior forms of life. By this stage, the candidates would have already been selected for assignment to particular countries. They would be shown films and given lectures which portrayed the customs and cultural habits of the foreign countries in a biased fashion. The people of those countries would be portrayed as enemies of the United States and were always spoken of in demeaning terms. They were often presented as if they were, quote, less than human. Their customs were ridiculed, and local leaders were presented as evil demagogues, even if they were legitimate political figures. According to Dr. Narut, it took only a few weeks to indoctrinate susceptible candidates by this process. Those who were not susceptible to the conditioning were dropped earlier in the program and returned to other assignments. Narut admitted that he did not have the necessary, quote, need to know as to where all the programmed men were sent, although at one point in his conversation with Peter Watson, Narut specified that programmed assassins have been installed in the Athens embassy. He said that his busiest time was when a large group of men went through such training towards the end of 1973, at the time of the Yom Kippur War. After the Oslo conference interview, Watson returned to London to file his story. Watson is the reporter for the Times and a former psychologist himself. Watson returned to London to file his story. Writing up the details, he found a few points which needed clarification, but he could not reach Narut either at his home or in his laboratory in Naples. Watson then asked the U.S. Embassy in London to comment on the information Narut had volunteered. The embassy passed the buck to the U.S. Navy.